From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, for many, a surprise announcement from a Baltimore prosecutor.
We have probable cause to file criminal charges.
We talk with the VOA reporter on the scene. You'll hear from Steve Herman in Nepal with the latest on the situation in that earthquake-ravaged country. And the United Nations expresses concern over what's happening in the African nation of Burundi. That and more, all ahead here on The Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman. The chief prosecutor in the eastern U.S. city of Baltimore has announced that there is probable cause to file criminal charges against the police officers involved in the arrest of Freddie Gray, saying the state medical examiner has determined his death in police custody last month was a homicide. Marilyn Mosby is that state's prosecutor.
The findings of our comprehensive, thorough, an independent investigation, coupled with the medical examiner's determination that Mr. Gray's death was a homicide, which we received today, has led us to believe that we have probable cause to file criminal charges.
VOA's Victoria Mackey has been covering this situation in Baltimore for the Voice of America. She joins us now. Victoria, what charges and what kind of charges do these Baltimore police officers face?
Well, what we found out from the prosecutor today is that they will be facing charges that range from murder, second-degree murder, to assault, to police misconduct. And sorry for the noise behind me, but what you're hearing is folks out in the streets in West Baltimore who are out in full force to celebrate what they're seeing as a victory for their community and their city.
Well, is that indeed all celebration that you're seeing, or are there any other kind of demonstrations for people who are unaware of the situation? Baltimore was the scene, at least a few days ago, of some violent protest. This seems to be positive, or no?
Absolutely. I've seen nothing but positive, folks out in the street. I'm actually in front of the CVS that was burned pretty substantially on Monday night in the looting and the riots around town. And people here, I'd say there's a few hundred. There's a heavy police presence, but everyone's really, really claiming this as a victory, especially because all six officers are going to be charged.
The overall reaction from this announcement by Ms. Mosby seems to be this was not expected. Is that pretty much the idea being circulated around the city, that this kind of took people by surprise?
I think people were hoping for, at least a few charging, a few of the officers to be charged. No one really expected all six to be charged.
Well, any reaction so far by police or police benevolent associations or any other kind of organizations that might represent police officers?
I briefly saw a statement by the Baltimore Police Union, I believe, and they are supporting their officers and defending their actions.
Victoria, thank you so much for being with us. That's VOA's Victoria Mackey from a very noisy section of Baltimore, Maryland. People celebrating what had been the announcement and has been the announcement of charges filed against several police officers, leading to the death of a man in Baltimore. Make sure you stay with us here on The Voice of America at voanews.com for further information and continuing developing information on this story. Now, VOA's Jeffrey Young spoke this morning with the head of the Greater Washington, D.C. Urban Leagues Group for Young Urban Professionals. It's called the Thursday Network.
Karis Goff is the president of the Greater Washington Urban League's Young Professionals Auxiliary, the Thursday Network. Now, let's hear your perspective on these events. How are young urban professionals impacted by all of this turmoil?
One, we just have a natural reaction to respond. We want to be engaged in any ways that we can support our communities. On the other side of this, with this particular situation, there's really that notion of being a young professional doesn't prevent you from being the next case. There's not a degree or a job that will save you from police brutality or issues of misconduct.
Some people say that in recent years, law enforcement has become more militarized, that in many cases, police engage citizens as if they were combatants, and because of that, violence takes place. What's your perspective on that?
I think the real change is that in recent years we have a change in technology that allows more attention to be called to the issue. So I think there's always been sort of these issues where citizens often feel that combative nature. But now we're seeing these incidents recorded with cell phone cameras so everyone can really show what they're witnessing. And social media has really changed the game where you can disseminate that information very quickly.
How is your Young Professionals Group constructively engaging the community and working to bridge the communication and trust gaps between the officials and the public?
We have started a plan that we call our Combating Police Brutality Action Plan, and that's something that we do in partnership with the Greater Washington Urban League as one of their auxiliaries. We have a plan where we've addressed what we would like to see from the community as far as citizen review boards, as well as just officers in schools and their training. And what we are really doing with that to address that community-wide is to have a series of town halls. So we've been meeting in different areas, and we invite law enforcement, community activists, legal representatives also to have a discussion about what's actually taking place and what citizens would like to see. So they are able to share their stories as well as ask questions of what is being planned by police to really change the course of the way things are going right now. Outside of that, with long-term solutions, we do have ongoing mentoring programs for middle school and high school students to give them good examples to really just raise responsible individuals who can become community leaders and continue this active work.
What would you recommend that they do to address the underlying systemic causes of community unrest?
There really has to be a holistic look at what is truly going on in the city. The folks who are protesting in Baltimore obviously did not become mad just this week and just over Freddie Gray. They look at the deeper economic issues. They need jobs where they can prosper and really be able to make a living wage. And then education is a huge piece.
Karis Goff is the president of the Greater Washington Urban League's Young Professionals Auxiliary, the Thursday Network. I'm Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
You're listening to International Edition from the Voice of America. Nepal is still coming to grips with the full extent of the devastation and misery caused by last Saturday's magnitude 7.8 earthquake. Some in the hardest hit communities have been cut off by landslides, making it difficult to assess the precise toll of casualties and destruction. But at last count, officially anyway, it was up around 6,400 people killed in that earthquake. A VOA news crew has been among the first to reach a few of the smaller remote communities. Our correspondent Steve Herman reports from the Sundarpolchak district, about 100 kilometers east of Kathmandu, which suffered greatly in Nepal's worst quake in more than 80 years.
The small fishing village of Maji Gaon, on the banks of the Indrawati River, exists on few maps. Now it has been wiped off the map. All 50 stone and wood homes tumbled in an instant when the quake shattered Nepal. To reach Maji Gaon, a VOA news crew drove for hours over roads just cleared of landslides and then hiked down a steep path on a terraced paddy field. Five people died here. One teenage boy is missing, and about 20 villagers were injured. Akash Maji says when those from Maji Gaon went to the closest town where aid was being distributed, they found it all already in the hands of relatively well-off shopkeepers whose properties were not seriously damaged.
We are in a helpless state. We don't have a place to stay or anything to eat.
Maji Gaon has existed for generations, but the fishermen are now debating whether they should bother to rebuild here.
If we construct the same kind of structure, similar incidents are going to occur. We don't have the money to build stronger houses, and who is going to take care of us? If an NGO or some social agency comes forward to help us, we are saved. Otherwise, we have nothing with which to survive.
In nearby Ratumati, in the Himalayan foothills, 12 people died. None of the red clay and stone structures is habitable. There are not just human casualties, but also livestock that have been lost. Trapped beneath these structures are goats, chickens, and cows. A buffalo that survived has already been taken away. It is a huge financial loss for people on a subsistence living. Injured survivors wait for help. It may be days or weeks before it reaches them. On the road back to Kathmandu, a woman who had been extricated from the rubble of her home was placed on the roadside. She had lain beside her dead husband for 5 days, suffering what appeared to be a broken back. The town's only ambulance was in service elsewhere. Without money to pay for transportation, there would be no ride to a hospital. A policeman finally flagged down a passing truck, convincing the reluctant driver to take her to the nearest medical center. The stretcher was lifted into the back for a bumpy one-hour ride. Steve Herman, VOA News, Sindhu Polchak, Nepal.
We move our focus now from Nepal to Africa, Kenya to be more precise. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is going to visit that nation next week to discuss security cooperation, trade, and human rights with Kenya's leaders. VOA's Gabe Josselo reports that rights groups are urging Kerry to use this opportunity to address alleged abuses committed by Kenyan forces in their anti-terror operations.
Kerry's visit to Kenya comes on the heels of the devastating terrorist attack on Garissa University College in the northeast, which left 148 people dead, most of them students. The al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab, an enemy to both Kenya and the United States, claimed responsibility. Tom Boya, a governance consultant in Nairobi, says security cooperation has to be a central issue during the secretary's visit.
Kenya has been victim to a number of attacks over the last few years, and actually since 2011 to actually probably more attacks than we've seen in any period before that. So that's of extreme concern to the majority of Kenyans, and is also an area of cooperation between Kenya and the U.S.
Counterterrorism has been at the center of U.S.-Kenyan relations since the 1998 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi introduced the names of al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden to the Western world. With U.S. support, Kenya has also targeted al-Shabaab militants in recent years, sending troops into Somalia and searching out terrorist cells at home. But rights groups have expressed concern over alleged abuses committed by Kenyan security forces in these operations, including harassment of Somali populations in Kenya and raids on the offices of Muslim human rights groups. Leslie Lefko, Deputy Africa Director at Human Rights Watch, notes that as the U.S. funds and supports Kenya's terror operations, it must hold their forces accountable.
Given that we've documented very credible allegations against units, including the anti-terrorism police unit, you know, the U.S. is obliged to respond to this and investigate and take measures.
Human Rights Watch and other groups signed a joint letter to Kerry urging the secretary to address rights issues directly to Kenya's leadership.
If we see these patterns continuing and the U.S. not putting these issues as firmly on the agenda as they need to be, then I think there will be really strong concern that the counterterrorism partnership is trumping these very serious human rights concerns.
Kenya-U.S. relations have had their rocky moments in recent years. They hit a low point ahead of Kenya's presidential election in 2013 when the frontrunners and eventual winners, Uhuru Kenyatta and his deputy William Ruto, were facing crimes against humanity charges at the International Criminal Court. They were accused of orchestrating the intertribal violence that followed the previous election. The ICC has since dropped charges against President Kenyatta, though the case against William Ruto is ongoing. Tom Boya says while the collapse of the ICC case against Mr. Kenyatta has contributed to improved ties, friendly relations run deeper than the politics of the day.
Kenya hasn't only had very warm relations with the U.S. On a diplomatic front, but also has, you know, in terms of the Kenyan people and the people of the United States, both of whom look at each other very, very favorably. You know, I went to university in the U.S., so I know this from my own experience.
Kerry's visit is also seen as a precursor to President Barack Obama's planned trip to Kenya in July. Mr. Obama has traveled to Kenya, the birthplace of his father, in the past, but this will be his first time as the U.S. president. Gabe Josselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
A United Nations agency is taking a closer look now at what is happening in the African nation of Burundi. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights says it is worried about increasingly repressive measures being taken by Burundi's government to stifle political dissent. Human Rights Office spokesman Rupert Colville points to a series of measures taken by Burundian authorities, which he says seriously curtail people's rights to freedom of peaceful expression and assembly.
Hundreds of people have also allegedly been detained since the demonstrations began last Sunday. And according to one credible report, over 400 individuals are being held in extremely overcrowded conditions, with detainees actually having to sleep standing up. It's so crowded. Detainees have also been beaten, allegedly, particularly on their feet and buttocks, and some of those who've been released have had trouble walking as a result of those beatings.
The International Red Cross reports at least six people have been killed in demonstrations following President Pierre Nkurunziza's announcement last week that he is planning to run for another term. Opponents say this is unconstitutional and violates the 2000 Arusha Agreement, which limits presidents in Burundi to two terms. Colville says High Commissioner Zeid Rad Al Hussein, at the end of his visit to Burundi a couple of weeks ago, essentially issued an early warning about the dangers of inflaming tensions as the elections approach. He tells VOA the High Commissioner was particularly concerned about the militia wing of the ruling party's Imbonerakure youth group.
The activities of that militia have been leading, according to refugees in Rwanda, arriving in Rwanda, one of the principal reasons why they've been fleeing across the border. So, you know, you've already got a refugee movement taking place. You've got a country with a terrible history. At the time we were there anyway, the ethnic element was not really an issue. But, one doesn't have to be a rocket scientist to say it could come one again, and that would be too awful for words.
More than 300,000 people died in Burundi's decade-long civil war between 1995 and 2005. The latest update by the UN Refugee Agency finds more than 26,000 people have fled Burundi because of violence linked to the elections. It says Rwanda is hosting more than 21,000 refugees, and thousands of others are heading for Tanzania and Democratic Republic of Congo. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A published report out says that aircraft at a U.S. military base in Djibouti are often placed in danger because of hostile or lax civilian air traffic controllers who oversee that camp's runways. The Washington Post, citing military documents and federal aviation experts, reports that controllers at Camp Lemonnier in Djibouti have been seen ignoring air traffic while playing video games, making telephone calls, sleeping, or chewing narcotic drug cot. It says the controllers have resisted efforts by U.S. consultants to improve their performance. In one case, a controller threatened a U.S. Navy officer with a lead pipe and threatened to slit Americans' throats if he ever saw them away from the base. Post says the situation has led to numerous close calls in the sky and on the runways, including a 2013 incident where a private plane carrying Djibouti's president almost collided midair with a Kenya Airways jet. An official at the Djiboutian embassy in Washington dismissed the report, saying he's sure the airport is safe and that if controllers were really sleeping or hooked on cot, there would be accidents every day. A protest by Israelis of Ethiopian origin, also known as Black Jews, has erupted in violence. At least 13 were injured, including demonstrators and police. We get more from Jerusalem and Robert Berger.
Hundreds of Ethiopian Jews clashed with Israeli police in Jerusalem during a protest against alleged discrimination. Demonstrators threw stones and bottles, and police responded with water cannons and stun grenades. The rally followed the airing of a video showing police beating an Israeli soldier of Ethiopian origin in what activists described as an unprovoked act of racism. Protesters carried signs saying, "Enough to police brutality, and the police are a disgrace." Panina Tamano Shada is a leading member of the Ethiopian Jewish community and a former member of the Knesset, Israel's parliament. She said it is unacceptable that the color of a person's skin should become an excuse for police to beat, curse, and discriminate. There are about 120,000 Ethiopian Jews in Israel, a small minority in a country of 8 million. Most of them immigrated during two major airlifts sponsored by the Israeli government in 1984 and 1991. The Ethiopians have had trouble integrating into Israel's high-tech Western-style society, but many of them believe race is the issue, not culture. It is very difficult to live this way, said a protester named Vanda Elig. He added that his son is afraid to go out in the street. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appealed for calm, saying that he unequivocally condemns the policemen who beat the Ethiopian soldier, and he vowed that they would be brought to justice. Mr. Netanyahu said the Ethiopian community is dear to Israel, and the nation is making great efforts to ease their integration into Israeli society. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
From Washington, this is International Edition from VOA. U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice spoke to a gathering of Arab Americans this week about the Obama administration's approach to Middle East policymaking. VOA's senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi reports Rice focused on issues ranging from the Palestinian-Israeli conflict to the threat posed by the rise of the militant group calling itself the Islamic State.
U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice strongly reaffirmed the Obama administration's commitment to the two-state solution that leads to a sovereign, independent Palestinian state.
The United States remains firmly committed to an independent, viable, and contiguous Palestinian state living alongside a democratic Jewish state of Israel in peace and security.
Her remarks came in a keynote address to hundreds of Arab Americans from around the country at the Arab American Institute Foundation's Khalil Gibran Spirit of Humanity Awards Gala. Rice said, while reassessing U.S. approach to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, President Obama made it clear that resolving the conflict is in the national security interest of the United States.
There must be robust provisions for Israel's security. The occupation must end and the Palestinian people must have the right to govern themselves.
Rice called on the upcoming new Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority to demonstrate through policies and actions a genuine commitment to a two-state solution. She said the Obama administration opposes the Israeli settlement activities and efforts to change facts on the ground because it makes it harder to negotiate peace in good faith. Rice reaffirmed the administration's vision for a feasible peace agreement.
Israel and an independent Palestine both need secure and recognized borders based on the 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps.
She said the United States continues to believe that a comprehensive peace between Israel and the Palestinians is necessary, just, and possible. The White House National Security Advisor underscored the progress that the United States-led coalition managed to achieve in the effort to degrade and eventually destroy the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria.
Together, we've conducted more than 3,500 airstrikes in both Iraq and Syria, damaging or destroying upwards of 5,700 ISIL targets.
She said, while ISIL lost control of 25% to 30% of the populated areas it had seized in Iraq and was forced to slow down its advance in Syria, rooting out the Islamic State from Syria would not be possible as long as the civil war persists. Rice said the U.S. firmly believes that there is no military solution to the Syrian conflict and pledged that the United States will continue to pursue a negotiated political transition. As for the crisis in Yemen, Rice said there is also no military solution, and that's why the United States is working with all parties to end the violence so that the United Nations-led political negotiations can resume promptly. Mohammed El-Shenawi, VOA News, Washington.
That'll wrap up our program for this day. Thanks for joining us on International Edition. Remember, you get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day at our website at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.